Hello and welcome to episode 6 of series 2 of the Agents Folk podcast. My name is Tim Cox. I am your podcast host. And today I'm really excited to have Hilary Hickmore as my guest. And we're going to be talking about igniting hope in the kind of last chance saloon for children and young people who are at risk of permanent exclusion. And so, as I always do, I'll offer the podcast floor to you, Hilary, to kind of introduce who is Hilary Hickmore, kind of what your journey with psychology has been, and how have we come to have this conversation?
I say, right. Well, thank you, Tim. It's lovely and scary to be here. So thank you for having me on board your podcast. I'm an EP I trained at Southampton finished in 1988. Seems like absolutely ages away now. I can't believe I've been going that long. I worked for a long time in Hampshire. Local authority is now Hampshire and Isle of Wight, EP service. And then I worked as something called the Healthy Minds Coordinator or Healthy Minds Manager. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like a team manager of a local authority, multi-agency hub, all for those kids who fell through the net of services, all supposed to be supporting the kids who were most vulnerable. Oh, and in between that, I worked in commissioning across Hampshire PCT and education for children with social, emotional and mental health needs again. Okay. And that was a fascinating sort of big picture commissioning, getting ducks in a row of different services, very much about needs analysis and making sure the right services were working and that all of the services tessellated to so that people didn't fall through the net of services. Mm. Fascinating and very difficult. And then I moved on to being an independent EP, working with an academy, a pyramid of schools. That was fascinating. Mm-hmm. It was like my own little EP empire. Mm-hmm. And then more latterly, I worked a little bit for Portsmouth and did that. And mainly now I do training for EPs, just because it's. I can't bear the idea of retiring, but I am sort of becoming less and less economically active.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? But I can't. I love psychology and I love educational psychology, and I also still think there's stuff to be done, and there's stuff that needs changing, and there's stuff to challenge in it, and stuff to develop in it, and in EP practice and in schools practices. And I'm not ready quite to let go of all of that, even though I'm getting on a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've got a huge wealth of experience in I guess working at different levels of different systems. Some quite kind of micro, some kind of very macro, some beyond, where I guess your average EP might have experience of working. I guess, that brings lots of new perspectives of working with different people in different ways. And that must have been fascinating. I'm wondering whether prior to training in 1988, whether there was a particular issue or particular psychology which drew you to the profession, or there was a sort of a sparking moment
I wouldn't say it was a sparking moment. It was very much childhood experience of growing up on reflection and as an adult realizing that my mum had some significant mental health difficulties that weren't seen as that, and she struggled. She had a real struggle, and that meant that our family struggled along with her, trying to support her and trying to understand her and manage around her needs. I think it's interesting. I've not wondered about that a lot, because I very early on in my career was very against exclusion or any element of exclusion around emotional and emotional behavioral needs. I mean, clearly I was against, I say clearly, but I was against exclusion on grounds of any sort of special need, including any kids needing to go off to special school and special provision of any sort, but particularly for kids with social, emotional, mental health needs, the fact that they seem to be treated so badly before they found, hopefully, some good provision. And actually, some of them never found good provision because some of the provision that we made available for them was in awful buildings and was in, or they'd have, you know, maybe 3 hours of individual tuition a week or something that was actually not legal. but local authorities around the country can give an impoverished education to kids, and yet these are kids who have suffered enormous life stresses and maintain and gone through awfully vulnerable, difficult periods of their lives, and they're treated so badly before finding what might still then be an inadequate provision for them. And once they're there, they tend to stay there, even though maybe the emotional behavioral needs that they were sent there for or sent out of the system for might have been transitory. And yet they're treated as a permanent sort of blight on this person and what they are able to access in the system. And I don't know why that was. And I wondered if it was something to do with my having been, as a youngster, I was from the age of about 10. I was taken out of the mainstream, out of state provision and sent to lots of posh private schools. I went to about three different posh private schools, and I didn't fit in because I was a Leeds girl who had a Leeds accent and didn't have lots of money and didn't arrive at school with a Bentley. I think I maybe experienced quite a lot of isolation in that sense and of being different and being sent out. So maybe that was part of why I had a hard time accepting that I was part of a system as an EP that was meant to rubber stamp and advise that a kid with a social, emotional, behavioural needs should be put somewhere else that I knew wasn't necessarily going to be good for them. When you consider the options available. So that within the first 2 years of my having got a job, that kind of became a mission, which I think I just carried on almost throughout the rest of my career, really. Yeah, I've got up in a bit of a one-track pony.
Well,
one-track record.
I think there's an element of, you know, reflecting on my last conversation with Chris Bagley, and actually many of the guests that I've had have talked about this issue, or have included this issue within what they've spoken about. There seems to be a kind of a real sense of just agreement that and consensus that there is an issue here, and a long-standing issue at that, which systems find very difficult to adjust to, and often, we're finding ourselves in positions where schools and education institutes are well-meaning, but are essentially reducing the diet of nourishment that these young people could get, which would be a protective factor, which would, inspire some hope and some trust, and a different way of seeing things. It's certainly a lot of what you've said. You know, my experiences of working in kind of alternative education, some of the school buildings I've worked in have essentially been on a building site where the rest of the school has been knocked down. And I often thought, this is quite a depressing place to come and work, but I'm being paid, not very much, but I am being paid to come here. And I feel very sad leaving it. and coming to it every day. So to have been told, lots of these children, that you're coming here for 6 weeks and you stay here for 4 years, that's very frustrating in itself. And I think there's something about this issue. And I naively thought, I think, back in 2015, where they changed behavioural, emotional, and social difficulties to SEMH. Aha, we're finally seeing this, you know, this sense that, you know, we can't just say because they behave wrong in our environment that there's something wrong with them intrinsically. But I think that was naive.
it's just shifted an acronym, hasn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think given that you found a way of working in so many different ways over a 30-year period, it shows that issue is one that we're trying hard to shift.
It hasn't proved hard to shift once I'd found the means to do it. So, for example, in commissioning in Hampshire, in mental health commissioning in Hampshire, we really did close the gaps between services. Mm. In doing that Healthy Minds Hub in Windsor and Maidenhead, we really did have this wonderful scenario where nobody fell through the net because we had this mandate to get together and say, regardless of what everybody's criterion are for whether or not you'll accept this particular family or this particular child, actually, if you come to this meeting and it seems like you're actually the best service that's going to be able to support them, maybe with a bit of help from that service and maybe thinking we'll go to that service next, well, then you've the right, the people around that table had the right to bend their rules for admission or for you know, criterion for acceptance, and make sure that we actually together as a community of services could offer something that was actually that gave us as professionals hope. That's it. I mean, where is the hope in a system if you have all of these holes where a kid can't be sent to that service because they're not bad enough, they can't be sent to that service because they're too bad, and that service then the wrong age, and that service they haven't got the right diagnosis, you know, so they're just the school and them and the family are just stuck with a problem that nobody will help them understand and find a way through. We're denying them hope at the most basic level there. And when, sadly, with social, emotional, and mental health needs, when that is persistent, everybody knows this, when it's persistent and it is difficult and it is challenging and it makes the staff supporting that child feel bad because of transference and intensity, or however you want to describe it, the electromagnetism that is there that we pick up between people, it makes you feel bad. It's natural that when they feel hopeless, those staff will want to distance themselves from that feeling and the person who creates that feeling in them. It's a feeling of hopelessness, it's a feeling of despair, it's a feeling of stress and intensity and yuck that kid is emanating that they pick up on. So of course they want to distance themselves from it, and that's where so much of rejection fits into our system around kids with social and emotional needs in a way that doesn't appear in other types of special educational need and disability, in my view. There's that personal emotional element that comes in on the part of staff and particularly on the part of senior staff, who sadly, once you get to deputy head level, they have the capacity to just press the eject button and exclude someone. They don't have that, and they're also not drawn to use it for other types of special educational need.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I can't remember why I was pondering on it yesterday actually, but I was thinking about head teachers and thinking, you know, when it comes to their retirement party, I doubt they cite zero tolerance policies and excluding people as career highlights.
No, okay,
but they would probably talk about turning around a school or turning around a behaviour, culture or something like that.
Yeah.
It just made me think, you know, this is something that really kind of worries me a little bit about, you know, zero tolerance behaviour policies particularly, is that they're kind of skimmed over as, well, you know, lesser of two evils, you know, Ofsted are coming, essentially. And that's always been something very difficult for me to accept, because the consequence of that exclusion is removed from a Mesa system or however you want to put it, of a school. But actually then the individual takes on the responsibility for something that's just a school can't meet or understand that needs, or staff are feeling pressured by, you know, that SEMH need. And that's something which I've been thinking about since kind of my conversation with Chris Bagley. Is that something that I reflect back? Is that something I would say, stop, don't do this? You know, we know.
Well, I think zero tolerance policies and, well, a number of types of behaviour policy that have got a structure which leads to a number of sanctions, which then leads to a fixed term exclusion, which then leads to an exclusion. Whenever that's in the structure, it sort of almost creates a sort of a system which legitimises pushing kids away rather than letting oneself stay exposed to and be contaminated by their emotionality. And actually being contaminated by another person's emotionality is very difficult. But in those schools that have been able to become trauma informed, or that have been able to, and before we were talking about trauma so much, and where I was busy sort of, I mean, one of the big things that I did, which made a lovely, lovely difference, and I did along with other colleagues in the local authority at the time, was we trained loads and loads and loads of senior staff who had the eject button at their power in a version of the CREST model, which enabled them to have means other than words for talking to kids about what behavioural, emotional yuck was going on that was creating the challenge that the system wasn't coping with. And by giving the key players who could press the eject button the tools to actually start to communicate well with kids and to start to be able to hear the pain behind the behaviour, hear the tangle and the self-deprecation and the self-disgust and the confusion and the distress behind the behaviour, that meant that they actually had the feeling that actually this isn't hopeless. I can get through to this kid. There are things we can do. I can empathise. It's not about me. I'm no longer made to feel helpless and hopeless about this kid, because I've managed to have this quality communication with him in which he has shared something very personal of himself, and I understand him better. And a kid with those sorts of difficulties better, that means that fundamentally it means there's hope on both parties, because understanding and empathy and shifting attitude based on that is the most profound basis upon which behavior change can happen, both in the adults as well as the child, because that increased awareness creates a bond between them, but it also creates an understanding and new information and new possibilities that they can see that they can do that are within their repertoire. And there's nothing more powerful, I think, for eliciting school support and school resources and school commitment and school energy to work to help a kid than being able to actually understand, communicate and really feel for them and with them rather than be contaminated by them.
Mm. I mean, that makes loads of sense. And I guess I was going to ask, how do we be hopeful in that dynamic, since you've got all those different experiences of applying that and getting people to work together to see this need, to validate it and to work together? I guess what I was saying at the start of that conversation is like, do I just come along and try and extrinsically reorient a school and say, don't do that, here's a goal you should be working with? But what you've done in terms of, I guess, hope theory is that you've developed with those senior leaderships a different pathway to think about this and developed agency against that, as well as saying that we should include children with these needs.
Yeah. I mean, so, I think I've done training till I'm blue in the face to staff at all levels about clever behaviour management systems and really great ways of running school and changing the ethos and you know, increasing positives and reducing sanctions and all of that sort of thing, and valuing kids and valuing all kids. None of that has had the impact that I think we were able to have from, first of all, starting off with individuals, actually, with individuals, working with individuals in a way that revealed to the school all of the painful tangles I talked about underneath the behaviour, which on the basis of an individual work, more and more schools... Once I started working using the CREST model, or I mean, it didn't used to be called that. I developed it over probably from about 1991, and for the following 4 years, I was learning myself, and I was developing it and honing it and trialing different activities and methodologies within it, and I was finding then in my patch of 21 schools or however many I had as the main grade EP, I was hardly ever being asked after a year or so, I was hardly ever being asked to do anything other than do assessments which would give them some insights into the child's emotional world. That's what they would write on the referral form, which was lovely. And I virtually never did anything other than that, unless a school had done all kinds of wonderful good practice in relation to special needs support and really knew that they needed some additional resources via a statement, as they were called then, an EHCP now. I would be occasionally involved in other sorts of assessments, but mostly my time was taken up. And at that was taken up doing these sorts of emotional world. Let us have some insight into their emotional world. And then that meant that they wanted training on what that was all about. Unfortunately, in the late 90s, there was a scenario came in where the government, there was the Visser-Coles Riker-Bell study came out in 1998, Daniels as well, which was a wonderful comparison of schools that had high exclusion records and good results, and schools that had very low exclusion rates and good results. And they interviewed loads and loads of kids and loads of staff, and they pulled out some fantastic findings around the commonalities between those schools that had very low exclusion rates and still had good results. And, you know, it was all about, from the kids' point of view, somebody listens to me, somebody understands me, somebody likes me, and I have fun here. with some people I can have fun. So there were those four key strands came out, and that so I mean that was such a wonderful thing that came out, and the government put in loads of grants then for schools, for local authorities to give schools free training. So we just did this amazing raft of training then, which is about having a laughing listening school and having laughing listening classrooms that were fun and people could be heard and understood. And that's when also we developed the counselling skills for head teachers and senior pastoral staff programme, which was free to them, which meant it was attractive to them, but they were very, very popular. And it wasn't just that they came for 3 full days of training, but then they had to sign up to coming for monthly supervision group sessions. Because we knew once they started really listening to kids and using these sorts of techniques safely within their capacities, then they would actually be exposed to some very distressing stuff that they were having to hold and be with kids with. So that's why the monthly supervision set in. And goodness gracious, that's still going ahead today. It's shifted somewhat, and it's moved more to it's moved away from supporting senior staff, I'm afraid. But that's the sort of model creep that you get when you leave places. The lovely thing is, in those schools that got those senior staff trained, their exclusion rates really reduced.
Yeah,
it was smashing. We had the local authority I was working at the time, their exclusion rates just dropped like a stone. It was superb to be a part of, and that's what makes me know that we can make a massive difference as EPs. What is hard, however, is the context change in funding. And obviously the context has massively changed in the last 20 years in relation to academies and how they work and traded services. Although having said that, in that context where the sorts of services that I'm talking about were known and appreciated, the schools, when it turned into a traded model, part traded model, were still buying in psychologists to do that sort of work, which enabled them to really have super robust pastoral care systems, which is nice.
It's a really good example of this idea that we can't just basically pigeonhole different types of work into this is just individual work or this is systemic work. What you're talking about is that, you know, the opening the child's emotional world has led to these large systemic changes, and research into that, and it's led to this kind of positive kind of virtuous cycle over time. And I was just reflecting that it seems, I think since I've worked in schools and worked in education, that there has been this kind of creep of the skills of counselling and that sort of thing seem to be now applied to teachers who also have a very high workload. And I guess that possibly triggers that kind of transference of negative emotion, perhaps quicker if there isn't that supervision and support. So I guess there is that does make the case for that. And just hearing that you've experienced these changes in, I guess, in culture and attitude towards education over your career, but there's still hope and there's still ways of applying those psychologies is very hopeful.
Absolutely, in
that sense, that's very encouraging to hear. Now you've talked a little bit, and you've made some references to your CRES model. And it'd be good to talk about that now. I mean, I'm I'm assuming the Cress model, you haven't called it the Cress model because you're in Hampshire and they produce lots of watercress and that's...
Well,
that's
I live in Alsford, which is where the Cress beds yes. are, which is why and Cress is, as a plant is terribly good for you. So. Yeah. It's actually C-R-R-E-S. It just, my initial acronym I chose for it was too like another acronym that is not been used, so I changed it.
Yeah. I mean, a brief aside is, we did work briefly at the same school and yes. perhaps, and I was a pastoral guidance manager at that point and you were the EP for the school, but that was just before I went to do my conversion course and started on this journey, so you will have had some influences somewhere, but I probably just wasn't aware of them at the time, so thank
That's
you
very
for that
sweet of you to say.
And it would have come down through my senior managers who were very engaged in that sort of thing. But yeah, so the Cress models. So we've got CRRES. So
should I start off by saying that it's actually a type of therapeutic assessment?
Yes,
so
that would be helpful.
In adult mental health, particularly in the States, and it's starting to come over in here, from the early 90s, there was a chap who started writing called Finn and Tossinger, two chaps, who started writing about therapeutic assessment. Basically, and that's a very, very different model to my one. And the two share the basic principle, which is a generic word therapeutic and the generic word assessment, in which the goal of an assessment that's a therapeutic assessment isn't just to collect information to then go and discuss with people, create an intervention plan. It's meant to, in the process of undertaking the assessment, to have a therapeutic change value in itself for the kid in the moment, but also for the kid after the session, not only by the seeds that you've sown in their thinking to enable their work to go on in their thinking and feeling after the session, but also in then with the kid hopefully present, taking through the key adults in their life, through the understanding that the kid has reached with the aid of these additional methodologies that we'll be talking about, so that we can really bring about a shift in understanding, attitude, perspective in the adults that are in the kid's immediate support network. And from there, we're not actually... It's not the psychologist pontificating on what might be the problem and what might cause the behavior. The kid is enabled to actually demonstrate what their emotional world is like, what their thinking and feeling world, what their mind states, what their belief systems and understandings and assumptions have been, and how that has affected their behavior. So once the staff and the parents can see that, and hear that and understand it differently, that's what can act as a springboard to them thinking, if that's the case, then this is what we can do. Rather than so the dynamic for me in consultation with the staff then is very different. It's more about enabling them to think through what they want to do and writing it down and shaping it in some sort of plan and making sure it's a multimodal plan and making sure that we've got a role for everybody involved, including the kid. That feels a very different place to me going into a room of people who are fed up, feeling hopeless, got their arms symbolically or really, really crossed in front of them with closed minds, thinking, we've tried everything. What's this psychologist going to add that's going to make any difference? Which is a very uncomfortable place, and one that I always felt I had to work until I felt those barriers dissolve. So that I really knew I'd got commitment and engagement for the planned way forward, rather than nods and a new behaviour support plan or IEP or whatever it's called that people were doing for the sake of it. The notion of us calling this Hope in the Last Chance Saloon, it's something to do with so many meetings before I started doing this work and that grew me to do this work. I would arrive and there would be a sense of Last Chance Saloon. It would be a sense of we're ticking off the EP involvement box and then we will exclude.
Yeah.
And then it proves to the world we've done everything.
Yeah.
And yet I knew that these people, because I'd had lots of contact with them over other types of special educational need, I knew they were great educators, and I knew that their heart and souls were for kids and for enabling kids, and yet somehow they were losing that when it came to emotionality. So the therapeutic assessment bit is meant to bring about change for the kid and for the system around the kid. In the process of assessment, which actually in its process makes change in that system and in the kid. So it's an intervention as well as an assessment.
Yeah. I mean, that makes lots of sense. And I mean, I think that kind of, it was good for you to kind of pull it back to what therapeutic assessment is, because it's not something that until we've had our conversation that I've really considered, you know, a therapeutic assessment. And I've often found that schools often kind of want me to do therapeutic interventions so that they can find out what to do with it, and that never seems ethically right, because you're trying to there's no buy-in from the student then. So this is a different way of thinking about that, and it feels more consensual from the young point. There's more in it for them rather than just to kind of be exposed.
I suppose the other thing is that I'm keen to, I know that as an EP, apart from those few, I used to manage to, there was a partial buy-in model in one of the local authorities, traded model, and some of my schools would buy me in and want to buy me in to do ongoing therapeutic work with kids.
Yeah.
I could only manage to do one piece of casework on a long-term basis at a time.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't have 21 schools dependent on one EP being a therapeutic person in all of that, because CAMS, can might have been unavailable for the particular kids we're talking about. It's really important to enhance and enable and enrich the therapeutic potential of those day-to-day folk, of parents and of teachers and of special needs assistants and of heads, those people who are there in every day. And Bruce Perry and Violet Oaklander and all kinds of wonderful people who've written on this before are saying it's not the role of therapists, the only role of therapists to be therapeutic. And we need to enhance the therapeutic milieu in which they're in. And so a therapeutic assessment, if it's done well, will enable the rest of the system to understand how to continue that therapy, because they've shifted and they've become capable of empathy, because empathy is the fundamental basis upon which a therapeutic relationship or connection can happen. And I know I've done my job in a therapeutic assessment when the key players have developed an empathic understanding with the kid. So that's wonderful. So shall I go on to say what CRESS actually is then?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So CRESS is one model of therapeutic assessment. And what it does is it basically offers a sampling framework that we can use to find the style and the medium of communication that a child can most easily use comfortably and safely for sharing their inner world, their thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs about themselves and their life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I needed different styles and medium of communication to be able to sample between. And that's what I look to humanistic art and play therapy to, because by adding facilitation process and carefully chosen activities from humanistic art and play therapy, and bringing that together with the sort of the rigor and efficiency of EP assessment, particularly dynamic assessment principles too, that created a wonderful sort of variety of styles and medium through which I could sort of do that sampling. And I could find the style and the medium that suited that kid. So for a therapeutic assessment, I wouldn't need to go away from any of the normal things that EPs do. If a kid can come into a room, have an eyeball to eyeball conversation with me in words about their behavior, their feelings, their thoughts, what's happening at home, what's happening in school, what might be troubling them. If a kid can come and talk to me about that, well then absolutely let's go there. If by just using some visuals like the strength cards or the feelings cards, that with a little bit of visual assistance we can for vocabulary say, they can use that to then talk about all of that stuff logically and comfortably, well then that's what we do. But if they cannot use words largely to put things to explore and explain their words, that's when I want to have a whole host of other ways of communicating to offer them. And that's where all of the activities that mm-hmm. CRESS offers and the different processes, facilitation processes that CRESS offers comes in.
What I'm hearing that kind of offers is kind of a flexibility and an enrichment of the ways that we can work with young people. Yeah.
The ways we can communicate and have that.
Yeah, and I found, you know, I'm quite a verbose person, and I, in terms of therapeutic models, I tend to go towards things like narrative therapy or Human Givens framework, both which rely on quite advanced use of words or metaphor or things mm-hmm. like that. And sometimes it's just like, for some children might be, you know, a scalpel, something very precise in its the use of its tool becomes like a baseball bat. It's not helpful. It's not a useful way to try and enter that child's emotional world.
Well, I think the thing that makes it clear to me most easily, and I don't know if it's happened to you, but it happens to a lot of people, is I know if I've got a lot of emotional stuff going, if I've got a lot of turmoil, a lot of upsetting stuff happening in, because of life does that to us all at some point, and I then need to go to work and be my professional self and have my, you know, be efficient, effective and smart and professional in work. And I walk into the office and somebody looks at me and says, "Are you all right, Hilary?" I go, "Yes, fine." And I scurry over and sit in my desk and work very hard to keep out of awareness all of the stuff that's troubling me, because if I let it come to the forefront of my mind, I'll probably be wobbly and gushy. And nobody wants to see a weeping EP sitting in the corner. Now, if we think, an emotionally literate person, there are certain scenarios in which I know if I put something into the stark currency of words by even saying something like, "Well, it's well spotted, it life's a bit crap at the moment," I know that then a flood of emotion would come. There's something about the stark currency of words and putting it out there in words, that you have that sense that there'll be a whoosh follows it. And that for some kids, particularly kids who have grown up maybe in a scenario where they haven't been emotionally contained, to know that if they experience that whoosh and flow of emotion that it'll subside, particularly those who maybe in the school context absolutely cannot be seen to be emotional, or what they may say as weak, or you know, they've got a sort of an image to put up which is about being tough and together, Or maybe it could just feel as though it would be so emotionally overwhelming to have that gush come forward of what you've spent all of, you know, years maybe trying to keep out of awareness and trying to stop thinking about. All of those kids who are sort of physiologically aroused, overactive, who can't cope with when the class is quiet and they're meant to be sitting still and concentrating because they need to have their brain distracted and busy. Because if they're quiet and there's stillness, then some of this stuff that they're trying not to think of or feel will perhaps peep through. Well, those are the sorts of scenarios in which they can't actually dare. It feels too threatening to put that into words, even if they had the right word for some of it. And some of it is so tangled and there's so much of it that you couldn't even contemplate working out where to start it with words. There are lots of reasons why words don't work for it. And what I would suggest is that by offering more symbolic, more visual, less direct forms of communication, it can offer a means of expression that feels safe and comfortable, and just sort of try, sort of almost let you see a hint of what my feelings might be a little bit about, and I can see what you do with that. And if you can see that and you can know that and you can actually look at it and be interested and not shocked and horrified, then maybe I can actually turn that into words afterwards, because I've tested you out and you actually can cope and receive a little bit of what I've hinted at. That's another possible element as to why it might work. But ultimately, because it can be symbolic and because it can be visual and because it's not words and you're not verbalizing it and it's going into the air where you can't bring it back and it's gone into your ears, it's somehow easier to put it there, and then you can always undo it and take it away again, or you can scribble over it, or you can quickly hide the bit that you've just put out there if the person's not going to receive it well.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it gives you more autonomy and control over how that's been seen, and it's more malleable than perhaps words, which are, you know, can build
momentum. They're there and they're out, and that's it, absolutely. So the CREST model then, the C stands for creative, because we need to use all kinds of creative media to enable a kid to find their expression. The two R's stand for reciprocal. It's very much like many of the other people you've spoken to, in that it's a humanistic model. It's therefore an equivalent process. The EP and the child are a level in their status in this. You're going into a journey of shared discovery, clarification and understanding, and the child's leading and teaching you, as well as following with, you know, some your facilitative route that you're providing. Mm-hmm. So they really are the expert on what's happened to them and what is happening to them and what's going on in their head, and can help you understand it. It's responsive. We could have dynamic in there, but it doesn't fit in an acronym terribly well. It's responsive in that if we try on a particular sort of activity for size with a kid, and we realize, well, that's not visual enough, it's not symbolic enough, it's too directive, it's too literal, then we quickly pick up their energy and their response and shift to offering them something different along four dimensions that I set out in the model, which are structured to unstructured, literal to symbolic, directive, which would be my agenda, to completely non-directive, which is the child's agenda, and verbal to visual. And those I call the dimensions of therapeutic dialogue. And I would say an awful lot of what we do, certainly in a cognitive assessment, is highly structured, highly literal, highly directive, and completely almost completely verbal. We're getting better, I think, generally at using more visual stuff. But still, because we're having to be effective and efficient, and we've got an hour in which to do wonders, we tend to be pretty directive and very structured, because that is the efficient way of doing things. Actually, for emotional and social communication, that may just be too tough. And so that's when some of the stuff from humanistic psychotherapy has allowed me to understand how I can undertake an assessment session which has no structure whatsoever and has no direction from me whatsoever and is completely symbolic, and still work with that in an effective way. And to play around with or experiment, or rather sample different activities at different places on those dimensions until we can find a comfortable place that works for that kid. And it's a special process doing that, and it's just lovely once you've found the right thing and the right sort of thing, and they can go in the flow with it, and you can see them relax and just go for it in terms of telling you something, because they've come to your session. They wouldn't come to your session if they didn't think, I hope this psychologist can actually help me out of this fix I'm in, you know. And sort of, you know, secondary age kids can vote with their feet. They wouldn't arrive if they think they don't want to, they don't have any idea that this meeting might offer them something. And then the last, the S at the end, is just an extra underlining of the fact that symbolism is really important. So it's symbolic too. So symbolism can enable the sharing of the most complex and special states of mind and states of being and views of self and views of the world and the people around you. So I would say that a lot of us revert to symbolism and metaphor, as you've already said, when words just aren't enough. So, you know, when we're in love, it's all about flowers and love hearts and poetry. And, you know, just saying I love you over and over again isn't enough, is it? So we're very symbolic souls, I think, as humans. And we in our culture, we've lost a lot of that. And yet it is a natural form of language which kids in their early play development use all the time. And then it sort of gets educated out of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's hearing you talk about it. I mean, I've obviously done my homework and read on it, but it's so inspiring to hear you talk about it, and to, you know, it's just reframed the way that I kind of see some of the work that I do with young people with these social, emotional, mental health difficulties, and that idea of using that sort of sampling framework to give them the voice to start to talk about what they'd like to do and what's going on for them. It's just made something click for me there.
Things clicking.
as you know, symbolically, it'd be a kind of a light bulb moment, but maybe this is a different way to talk about this issue. Whereas usually I go down the line of helping the people within that child's system to understand what they might be trying to communicate.
Yeah.
You know, what emotional need isn't being fulfilled, or you know, what emotional state they're in, but actually to directly give them the language.
Well, actually, Tim, yeah. I ought to say, I would never jump straight into doing a therapeutic assessment. I'd always try and deal with most SEMH needs involvement by consultation. And an awful lot of staff and parents go a very long way with consultation, and often that's all that's needed, and they end up, you know, taking off and going in a new direction and everything moving forward gloriously. I would use therapeutic assessment direct work, and then the work which is equally a therapeutic assessment session after I've seen the kid with the key people, if consultation on its own hasn't actually yielded a scenario where staff are feeling hopeful, positive, committed, engaged, and with a clear direction forward.
Yeah.
If they're not feeling those things and they're actually feeling stuck, hopeless, and low energy, and even perhaps starting to feel negative and rejecting, that's when I know I've absolutely got to go into this, do an individual assessment, and probably use this, because again, in most of the schools I work with, I know that I've made sure that there's been staff who are trained in very good active listening skills, and often some of these sorts of creative means of expression as well. And therefore, if those excellent pastoral staff haven't managed to get some insights and a communication with the kid, well, then I know I need to have this up my sleeve, because if the kid clams up with excellent pastoral staff, well, they're probably not going to be able to use words with me either.
Mm. But what a wonderful thing to have up your sleeve.
Absolutely. You have to have quite baggy sleeves.
Yes. Yeah.
It's well, like a big kit.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's kind of giving me an understanding where you'd apply this in practice, and that's really helpful and clear. I'm wondering whether, you know, we move on to talk about, you know, before this conversation, we sat down a few weeks ago and worked through something like this. We didn't say this is the CREST model and now I am doing this and now I'm doing that. But we had quite a profound conversation about how I was doing using these techniques. I don't know whether it's best. Yeah, I mean, could you just preface it a little bit before I kind of wash it with my misunderstanding, perhaps, of what was going on, etc.?
Well, it was lovely of you to suggest that we do a session, although I did find it challenging when I was thinking about it, because I was thinking, this isn't a person who can't talk about difficult, complicated stuff of one's own psychology. You are highly eloquent and articulate on all of those sorts of things, and very good at reflecting on yourself as well as on psychological theory and principle. So I was thinking, goodness me, could it possibly offer Tim anything? And given that Tim's not coming to me with a problem to solve in a way, well, what can CREST offer? So we did the most symbolic, unstructured, non-directive activity in the CREST list of activities, in fact, which was just called You. And it's an activity which starts where I say, so I'd like you just to use some of this stuff that we've got here to make something that's about you and how you feel in your life. And you had collected an interesting array of collage material that I hadn't seen. So that was another challenge for me, because I'm normally very precise about the array of materials that somebody needs to have at their disposal. And so we both entered into it in an appropriate shared sort of curiosity around whether this would actually offer you anything that was of note and could add anything to what you'd already spent, you know, were very good at thinking about. So that's my sort of prescript to what we did.
Yeah, I mean, just for the listeners' information, we did record that, and you'll be able to. There'll be a link in the description of this episode that you can go and watch that. It's about 35 minutes long, but it was a very helpful conversation for me to have, and helped me to shift into action over some things that were persistent issues. If you've listened to the conversation I've had with Cathy Atkinson, some of the issues have reappeared around my thinking around work and life and all of those sort of things. I was quite nervous. As you said, you were nervous coming into this conversation. I was quite nervous about that particular activity, because I have quite a strong story about myself that art, as in drawing, collaging, all that, is not my it's not my best skill. But reflecting on kind of a couple of things that you've said in this podcast, what it helped me to, I guess I have this very strong sense that when I go to work as an EP, I go with a strong, rational, logical, sort of slightly dissociated from my emotional experience some of the time, kind of mask on. It's like, Tim is now at work. He's wearing his tweed suit and, you know, he talks in a particular way. And there's, there's quite a structured way of me kind of presenting myself in some ways. Now, underneath that, particularly over the last lockdown period until the last couple of weeks, there's been this sort of incoherence between how I feel in myself and how I present. And actually, I think if there is that incoherence, actually that mask disintegrates. And it can be quite, it feels like a falling sensation in some ways, is that, oh, this thing that I produce, actually, I'm actually just the imposter. I don't have any substance behind me. So approaching this thing, I was kind of aware of that and perhaps worried what this less structured way of talking about things, and I guess a way that I, using a different way of communication, that I was less well versed in presenting that way of being, what was slightly daunting in some ways. But I found, you know, we did essentially a drawing and then a bit of a collaging activity. It allowed me to present symbolically this situation that the Tim beneath the sort of professional mask was what was in. And because it became a symbolic representation, it allowed me, that seemed to be then something that could be moved around and understood in a way which wasn't just general kind of murky, things aren't going well, everything's bad sort of way. And I think that was kind of my kind of, the profound nature of that, although it's stuff that I talked about before and talked about and talked about and talked about, the fact that it was something that was malleable and there and expressed in a different way than I usually would, it stayed with me and I wasn't able to compartmentalize it in the way that it would just reappear at another time, where talking about stuff, I can just do that. But I think that's part of, you know, sometimes having difficult conversations with people, that you're able to kind of, well, I'll compartmentalize that for later, and you know, hopefully that doesn't lead to you know, a bad flow mood or something at some point. I'll need to get that out at some point. But it was, yeah, it was a, you know, artistically, I mean, it wouldn't have sold in the gallery, but it did stay on my desk and did keep those ideas live for longer than just having a conversation would.
And the thing I liked about the conversation too, and what you did, was that you produced a scene. You were able to talk at huge detail about all kinds of symbolism that you'd used in that. But then at the end, towards the end, when I gave you the opportunity to, you started to experiment with what it would be like if you had some different elements in it, or if some of the difficult pressurizing elements were moved further away from you and some of the more nourishing elements were brought closer to you. And it sort of allowed you to play in with concrete materials in front of you, that all had strong meaning, to play with possibilities about how they might be. And I love what others have written about hope, in saying that hope is quite a vulnerable thing to do, and it's a little bit linked with dreams and and a hoping of what might be and of possibilities. And if you've allowed yourself to think and even make concrete and make clear in front of yourself something that might be possible or that you really would hope for or that you want or that is your dream. Well, if you've been able to articulate that and produce that somehow, it means that that neurologically you can be more start, you can start subtly to and unconsciously for you to be looking out for those opportunities and for sort of becoming attuned and directing all of your thinking and your being and your behaving towards those goals that are sort of starting to be able to be formed as concrete doable things. But it starts with being able to hope and being able to hope for something that you define. And I think you managed in the activity to define what you wanted to do with elements of thoughts and feelings in your head. Because you had those thoughts and feelings as things on the paper, you could move them around. And that seemed to be quite a special thing, which I don't think I could have enabled you to do by talking about it.
Absolutely. I think, you know, part of the scene is that I had this star which represented the things that gone well and my aspirations and those sort of things. And I think in the week, and the last kind of thing I did was put a smaller star, but just closer to me. Mm-hmm. And it was that sort of realization. Yes, I have kind of achieved the doctorate. I've done all these things where previously I probably would have thought about if I do that, then my life will be great. Mm-hmm. But it's that sort of kind of what next syndrome, you know, mm-hmm. I need to start orienting in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think made me reflect on the times where I've done that before. And it's actually, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably, you know, if my life was a kind of, kind of mosaic thing, it'd be the pattern that you see all the way through is you know, this idea of set this big goal, eventually work around to achieving it, mm-hmm. and then experience this sort of confusion afterwards as you don't know what to do, and then you work your way out of that. I guess the kind of other side of that kind of model was about, I guess, being in kind of oneness and being in the moment with nature and with my partner and things like that. And when I've done that, since that, I can almost bring to mind that part of it. So I'm doing yes. that thing that I represented there now.
Yeah.
And that links to this other stuff. Whereas before, when I talked about it, it's like, well, I should do that. And I should do this, but you know,
but you had this real beautiful image that you made of when you have your small goals closer to you and you have nature and being out in it closer to you, that those other pressures moved further away, didn't they? And that was a lovely image to see happening. And you, the other lovely thing you introduced was a really big, powerful red stop sign.
Yes.
Which was stop being in my head thinking about all of these difficult things that I have to do that are actually quite stressful. I need to be allow myself to have a very prominent stop sign, mm-hmm. that I then look to what I need. And I think that was a special thing to allow yourself to include.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's having that symbolic representation of stop. Stopping is something that I'd kind of probably professionally pride myself on not doing. I've always got projects on the go. I'm always doing lots of stuff. But actually, eventually, even though loads of stuff has gone really well, that does come home to roost when you can't, you know, when you miss a night's sleep or you do have 15 reports to write in 2 months or something like that. You can't always, you have to stop at some point. And even if it's just to be or to reevaluate what you're going to do or reprioritize. It just made me take some actions on what stopping meant. Mm. And I think reaching out beyond the kind of the the foggy head that I had to other people and say, I think I'm in a bit deep here.
Mm.
What do I need to do? And often they were reflecting back, well, just do a bit less and just enjoy it a bit more. Mm. And it's allowed me to, you know, right a wavering ship, which was kind of unsure what to do.
What I wanted to say a little bit about was, I suppose, what I was trying to do in the process of that activity. I quite a lot of the time I reflected back just exactly the words you use, because one of the things when you're giving a narrative of when you're narrating or describing what you've done, I wanted you to not just say it but to hear me say it back to you, so that it sort of became something that you became even more aware of. This the whole process is about heightening your awareness of how you interpret your symbolism, because the symbolism gives you this whole new way of knowing, an additional way of knowing who you are, what you are, and what you're feeling and thinking. You interpreted your symbolism, but I needed you to hear that again. So I was doing a lot of repeating of what you'd said. And also I was doing lots of giving you permission to explore something further and to put more on and to put bits on that you'd left off because you thought maybe, I don't know, whether time was up or maybe whether was it important enough, but lots of permission giving to actually include all of the important things in your life and not let certain things be diminished in value because of whatever that might have been stopping you from putting them there. One of the lovely things that I was drawn to realize was over and over again how we as facilitators, EP facilitators in this work, cannot impose our symbolism, our meaning, our interpretation of somebody else's symbolism. So you did this wonderful picture element near the end of that was represented lots of people that were important to you in your family and friends out that are a long way away, and you chose some like soft cotton wool balls, and I was saying so it looks to me as though you've got these soft balls that look like they're sort of nurturing and warm. That was my interpretation of what they might be, and you said yes, and you pressed them and you kept pressing them, and you said they've got depth.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, wow, you know, I can see that Tim relates to people deep on a deep level, and he likes people who've got depth and who are willing to share and engage in that sort of meaty thinking. And I would have never have projected depth as a quality onto a cotton wool ball. I thought soft, woolly, cuddly, that sort of thing, and that was so wrong. And depth was what it meant for you. And I think just was a lovely example of how important it is to ask a client the meaning in their symbolism rather than us assume we might know what they mean.
I found in those exchanges that I wasn't having to dig deep for the symbolism. The symbolism was there. It was it was very easy to access, and I think that was the worry at the start. It's like I'm going to have to dig deep and really think about why I'm doing this. But as you start to put it together, and you're responding and you're feeding back to what I'm saying, is that you are very present in the room. But I've got this relationship with this concrete thing, which I'm now shifting around and feel quite kind of like, oh, this is a way of looking at myself. Without having to make, you know, the kind of intense eye contact and stuff that I'd worry about when I was trying to pull forth those things that were meaningful to you as well as to me. It felt very fluid.
Good.
And it was a really, really good experience and kind of different way of framing how I saw things. And it was good to do that. And it's now on my desk at work.
And everybody passing by wondering what the hell Tim's been up to.
That's where all the Thrive equipment went.
That's where my cotton wool balls are.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it was a great experience, and you know, hopefully, the kind of the listeners can go away and view that and kind of take their own, you know, seeing it, their own kind of experiences from seeing that and seeing. Yeah. You know, I don't know whether it was something that was easy to facilitate or whether it was like, you know, drawing blood from a stone, but it felt quite fluid and just it felt to the person who was the centre of it as something that was quite easy to have that conversation.
I think the essential quality in one of these conversations is it's very much based on humanistic principles, which is about being real and being genuine. Mm-hmm. And you know, if it had felt uncomfortable, we would have agreed with each other that it was feeling uncomfortable and it wasn't the activity for you, and we'd have done a different activity. And I was very much aware of, you know, via Zoom, it's quite hard to pick up on some of the non-verbals, particularly seeing as I couldn't see you at all on screen. Because I needed to see what you were making. So, you know, I was very much hoping that I was going to be able to pick up through your voice tone and the nature of your answers and pauses and such, that as to your degree of comfort. And you soon seemed to be in flow, which meant it felt okay to go on. So I'm glad you've confirmed that it didn't feel highly uncomfortable for the whole time.
Absolutely.
I ought to say that is one activity of the GRESS model, which has about 12 activities in it, and it is the one which is most I've just got a dog on my lap.
That's okay.
It's the one that's most symbolic, least structured, least directive. And starts off, well, I mean, there's a lot of verbalization goes on, but it's sort of after you've created what you've created. It's not the what you've made acts as a springboard to lots of conversation. It doesn't always do that with kids. Sometimes kids stay with the symbolism and then one's left talking perhaps in the symbolism. But the other activities, some of them are far more structured, some of them are far more directive. All of them are pretty visual, and some of them are a lot less symbolic.
So I guess the question that leads on from there is that if people are interested in this and want to develop this, where can they find out more?
There's the crestmodel.com website.
There we go. And does that have information about the different types of things that you could be doing? And
it doesn't include the 12 activities because I feel strongly that in order to be able to deliver to use the appropriate facilitation methodologies, because they're very new working with these things, that one needs training, and also in order to use the activities, I suppose if safe seems a strong word for EPs, because I'm sure EPs would deal with them very, very carefully. But I think EPs, anybody using these activities, needs to have experienced them as a client, being facilitated by somebody who's experienced in facilitating them first, so that they know the power that they have, and so that they know just how carefully to use them. And so I put lots and lots on the website about the model, about where it came from, and also, you know, the dimensions of therapeutic dialogue. But I don't put on the actual activities, and I don't think I put on all the detail of facilitation skills, so that might feel a little unsatisfying for people, but there's a reason for those being missed out. I think they do need to come with training.
And if people wanted to access that training, is that about getting in contact with you via the websites?
They can do it by the website. I'm on Twitter as well. I'm on LinkedIn.
I mean, I think that's I'm aware that I've taken quite a lot of your time at this point, and I'm just kind of, for me, it's been a really helpful and moving discussion where I've had some kind of light bulb moments, which have made me think about talking to you more about kind of specific things that I could go and do as my career progresses. And there's I'm coming out of this conversation with lots of questions, but those are questions for myself and my own time. So I'm wondering if you kind of got any concluding remarks about the use of this model, about working with children at risk of exclusion, and that sort of thing.
I would say it's not a model to use just for kids at risk of exclusion. I would say it's for use in any context where people and the kid are stuck, really. Mm-hmm. where there's something that's troubling the youngster, or they're obviously not flourishing, and we want to understand a little bit more to be able mm-hmm. to help, because our pontifications and our theorizing and our hypotheses and the actions coming out of those haven't made the difference that we need. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, I think with this idea of this tool that could be up my sleeve, should I wish to pursue it, it gives me some hope about, as kind of Chris Bagley was talking about, challenging different systems, helping, and to also bring that idea that central to the idea of Agents of Hope is that the central conversation, the central language of education is often hope. And you can go into the Last Chance Saloon and you can bring a way of talking in that through consultation, through therapeutic assessment, which changes, you know, from arms crossed to open to learning. And for me, that's magic.
Yeah, magic sums it up, I think. Yes, thank you for that.
Okay, no problem. Well, I'll just end it by saying thank you very much, Hilary.
And
look forward to hearing more. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. I look forward to hearing some of those questions you've got.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.